Hey guys, this is Beth Golay. And before we get started with Marginalia, I just wanted to say that KMUW's podcast platform is made possible by High Touch Technologies, a software technology and business communications company that provides products, services, and support to all industries. High Touch brings the human touch to technology with a world-class team of industry experts. Learn more at hightouchtechnologies.com. And now, here's Marginalia.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia, notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
It's often said that fact is stranger than fiction. Dexter Palmer took fact and created fiction in Mary Toft or The Rabbit Queen, a fictional story based on a factual Mary Toft who in 1726 convinced the medical community that she was giving birth to rabbits. I recently sat down with Dexter Palmer to talk about this strange story. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Mary Toft or The Rabbit Queen is fiction, but it's based on a true story. But because it seems almost stranger than fiction, I was wondering if you could set it up for our listeners. Do you have an elevator speech? Who is Mary Toft?
Okay, so Mary Toft is a woman who, in rural England in 1726, hoaxed a number of people, including some esteemed medical doctors, into believing that she was giving birth to rabbits. She convinced people that she had given birth to 17 rabbits between September 1726 and January 1727. And then eventually the hoax was revealed as such, and a lot of interesting things happened as a result.
Now, I read in your acknowledgments that you first heard of this story when you were in graduate school at Princeton in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. What captured your imagination about Mary Toft?
Well, it was such a strange story. And one of the ways that I eventually ended up sort of thinking about it was that a historian can record the facts of the case, right? They can record what happened, whereas the constraints of what writing history involves sort of mean that you can't really speculate on what was going on in people's heads. And so the question that was really interesting to me was, why on earth would people believe this thing that was sort of self-evidently false? And so the idea, I guess, got stuck in my head, but I hadn't actually thought that I would sort of write a novel about it until like years later. And every once in a while, I would come across something related to the case, and I would just like file the material away. And then eventually, you know, in like 2016 or so, I ended up discussing this idea with my editor and agent and decided to go forward with it as a book.
Now, I wanted to touch on something that you mentioned about people's willingness to believe. And I read in an interview that you gave to Electric Literature in which you said the ability to deceive oneself is much more powerful than we would like to believe that it is. You know, talk to me a little bit about that in regard to believing the absurd, you know, the medical curiosities and Mary Toft. But also, you know, that's not necessarily an 18th century phenomenon, is it?
No, it isn't. One of the things that I started to think about when I was writing the book is that the only way I could come up with that these people would actually believe that this stuff is going on is because they wanted it to be true so badly that they ignored not just sort of common sense, but sort of facts that would prove that the contrary was occurring. And I think that sort of that willingness towards self-deception, you know, as I came to realize, we're just like figuring out the characters, was just extraordinarily compulsive. And yes, that is not just an 18th century phenomenon. A couple of people have remarked that the book just seems to, in some ways, rhyme with sort of things that are going on in popular media, in politics, and things like that. I do think, for instance, that social media allows us to pick and choose bits of information that confirm a particular perception of the world that we find is most pleasing to us rather than the one that is most likely to be true.
You know, early in the book, John Howard and his young assistant, Zachary, they pay money to see the exhibition of medical curiosities. It's a traveling freak show of sorts. And as these exhibits, quote unquote, were displayed, the ringmaster, if you will, explained the medical theory that accounted for the parade of monstrosities that marched before his audience. And that is, quote, a principal influence on the shape of a newborn child was the state of mind of its mother during the months of her pregnancy. The mother's obsession, sin, or failure was reflected in the flesh of her child. And I remember something similar from, first I thought it was Claire Clark, and first I thought, was that The Great Stink? But then I think it was The Nature of Monsters, where, you know, this belief of maternal impression was actually a belief at the time, wasn't it?
Yes, that's correct. So some of the examples of that sort of freak show exhibition are actually toned down versions of what I found when I was doing my research. The sort of the stuff that people would pay to see was actually like a lot crazier and more than I thought that my readers might actually be willing to buy right off the bat. The story about like sort of the mother's state of mind influencing the child comes from this sort of, I guess, quote unquote, collection of medical folk tales that was in circulation during the period called Aristotle's Masterpiece, where this idea was set forth as something that was, if not entirely factual, then something that was close enough to it to not make a difference. And this was a way that I started to see like people thinking about like the Mary Todd phenomenon as a thing that could actually be something that people would believe.
So what draws us to the grotesque?
First of all, I think we're just at a visceral level. I think we just like grotesque things. There's like a sort of a thing that's beyond explanation where we just like to like read about something and get the shivers or see it or something like that. One of the things that I thought about a bit when I was doing some writing was the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, where you see these sort of like deformed bodies, you know, that are kept preserved in sort of in chemicals and things like that. Even if it's sort of a pleasure that comes from thinking there, but for the grace of God go I think there is some sort of a pleasure in the grotesque. The other thing that I started to think about, this relates to something I was thinking about when writing the book, is that it is in some ways closer to horror than the two other books I've written. The idea of someone giving birth to rabbits is on its face absurd, but it's also terrifying if you're actually to sort of see this sort of thing happening. And so one of the things I realized when writing is that horror and comedy are in some ways very close to each other. They're very close cousins because what they do is basically establish a pattern and then deviate from that pattern in a way that we find surprising. The difference is that comedy tells you a joke and makes you laugh, and horror scares you. And so one of the things that I wanted to do is try to simultaneously get across the fact that the sort of the Toft rabbit births are deeply unsettling, but also actually kind of funny and appealing in that particular way.
Were there any particular characters that you liked drawing out more than others?
Let's see. I had a lot of fun writing Zachary, who is a completely invented character, because one of the things that I realized that I needed was a character who doesn't know much about the world so that he can act as sort of an avatar for the reader who might not know too much about 18th century England. So Zachary can ask these questions and he can have authority figures answer them. And it was fun to sort of write this initially naive character who sort of starts to learn about how the world works. John has also an invented character, his wife Alice, who is a sort of a, I wouldn't say cynic, but who seems to find the whole sort of thing amusing. And her dialogue was a lot of fun to write.
You know, one character that I loved because you made me dislike her so much was the mother-in-law, Margaret Toft. Was she fun to write?
Yeah, she was. And she's sort of almost a, she's sort of a horror movie character because she just sort of stands in the back and doesn't say much of anything. And the things that she does say either are deeply upsetting or don't make any sense at all, which is upsetting in its own way. I had a lot of fun doing her, yeah.
Your first two novels were more speculative fiction, and this one is more historical fiction. And even though it's fiction, there's a long bibliography included where you explain your work and some of the works that you used as reference. Do you prefer one type of fiction over the other?
That's an interesting question. I mean, one thing, so this book was in some ways new to me. Because I'd never done historical fiction before, obviously. But one of the things that I realized when writing is that speculative fiction and historical fiction, the skill set to write them both is actually pretty similar. And this goes back to what I said earlier about having this character who asks things about how the world works. Because in both speculative fiction and historical fiction, you're describing a world that neither the writer nor the reader has firsthand experience of. So in some ways, from a purely formal perspective, it doesn't matter whether I am describing like an alternate history version of the 20th century as I was in my first book, or the near future of the United States as I was in my second book. The skills are sort of the same. The research is different. I mean, I end up in a different section of the library. And I think as to the question of whether I prefer one more than the other, after I finished my second book, I thought, wow, writing speculative fiction is extremely difficult and I want to try something different. And then after this one, I thought, wow, writing historical fiction is extremely difficult. I want to try something different. So I might end up doing another sort of speculative fiction novel again. I'm not sure. I haven't decided yet. But yeah.
You know, I want to circle back around to, you mentioned social media earlier, and you wrote in a blog post on your website regarding Twitter, from which you are currently on hiatus, but you wrote, aspects of it seem specifically engineered to make smart people into sloppy thinkers. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think Twitter actually, it rewards snap judgments, and it rewards extreme positions at the expense of nuance, I think. Pretty commonly, I feel like you see like sort of a tweet that is, for example, like an outraged sort of response to a screenshot of a paragraph from an article, where if you look at the actual article, you'll see something that is much more carefully reasoned than the screenshot actually lets on that it is. I haven't been on Twitter since, I've only sort of visited it once since Christmas, just to basically check a notification. And I sort of have the feeling that I imagine one gets after one has stopped smoking cigarettes for a while, and that I find that my days are a little more, like they give me a little bit more free time to think. I find that I can sort of think more clearly and more carefully for longer periods of time. But that may just be me. There are like a lot of people on Twitter who seem to sort of like spend their, you know, a whole lot of time there. They're able to do quite useful things with it. But it doesn't seem to sort of work with my state of mind at this particular moment.
That was Dexter Palmer, author of the book Mary Toft or The Rabbit Queen, which was published by Pantheon. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torrin Anderson. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.